You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. School cafeterias serve millions of meals to public school kids every day for free. And here in California, there's a growing movement to get more local farm-fresh produce onto all those lunch trays.
We want to get the most nutritious, most delicious produce that we can to local kiddos.
Anna Knight is a fifth-generation orange farmer in Redlands, and she and her family are at the heart of the farm-to-school movement here in Southern California. For almost 20 years, the Knights have been connecting produce grown by small farmers around the Inland Empire to nearby public schools. And more operations like theirs will soon be sprouting up all across the state. That's because California is doling out $60 million this year to build connections between small farmers and school districts. KCRW's Robin Estrin went out to the fields to see what that could look like.
When Anna Knight talks about delivering local produce to local school kids, she means local.
Do you see that second little hill towards the right?
Yeah.
At the base of that hill is Moreno Valley Unified School District. You can practically see the building where they're going to go. And these are the kids who grew up in this community, who go to schools right around here. This is how close they are to their farms.
We're standing on a watermelon patch in Moreno Valley, south of San Bernardino. The farm belongs to Sunny Park, who's here wearing a plaid shirt, blue jeans, and a sheepish grin. He says, he had never farmed in his life when he pooled together a few thousand dollars from other Korean seniors to buy this land. In fact, Park was a Samsung engineer in South Korea before moving to the U.S. in 1981. Park started working as a produce wholesaler. Then, 24 years ago, he saw an opportunity to grow food himself.
홀세일을 하다가 보니까 월급쟁이 했었고 그래가지고 안 되겠다 싶어가지고.
Now on these 20 acres, he grows squash, leeks, green onions, and watermelons, all from Korean seeds. Watermelons take about 90 days to grow. When they're perfectly ripe, the 68-year-old farmer harvests them from the vine himself. He says he can fill a bin with 700 pounds of watermelon in an hour.
이제 많으면은 저는 뭐 그렇게 열심히 안 따니까.
And he adds, that's when he's taking his time.
저기도 왔다 갔다 하고 따서 여기다 갖다 놓고.
Park says he likes knowing kids in the area are getting fresh, high-quality fruit grown without pesticides.
다른 거 없어요. 맛있고 애들이 농약 안 준 거 갖다가 먹으니까 좋고 난 딱 그거예요.
Year after year, farm to school is becoming a bigger share of Park's business. In his last harvest, 70% of his watermelons went to local schools. Park is one of 20 small farmers in the Inland Empire who work with Anna Knight to serve 35 school districts in the area.
These 35 districts represent 1.5 million kids, okay? And we're not talking about just, okay, one order here and there. We're talking about on a weekly basis. Those weekly orders are what makes such a difference to farmers. It becomes an income stream that they can rely on.
Once the watermelons leave Park's farm, they travel to a nearby commercial kitchen where they're sliced into perfect pink triangles, and tied up in plastic bags. They spend one night in a giant refrigerator in the Knights' packing house in Redlands, and the next morning, before the sun has even risen, pallets of fruit are loaded onto the Knights' white delivery truck headed to local schools. The truck's first stop is Baldy View Elementary School in Upland, where they deliver a wide variety of fruit.
So these kids are getting local Valencias that were picked yesterday afternoon here on this farm, sliced, bagged, and they're on this pallet now. So watermelon, pre-sliced orange, they are getting apple pears, which just started about a month ago, and they're also enjoying plums and pluots.
Farm to school doesn't just benefit small farmers like Sunny Park. Fruit that's picked and delivered at peak ripeness is also way healthier.
The nutritional content of produce just declines The longer that produce is in transit, if you were to pick an orange, okay, from a supermarket, that orange took 5 weeks to get to you. It was picked in South America. It was taken to a packing house. It was waxed. Its box was fumigated and gassed. It got put on a ship, and it takes 5 weeks to reach your plate. But the oranges that we have in this truck were picked yesterday, were sliced yesterday. That is peak flavor and peak nutrition.
So that makes me really happy. Just the dietitian in me, you know, my soul sings a little bit in that.
Ksenia Glenn is the nutrition services director for the Upland Unified School District. She's standing near the back door of the Baldy View Elementary School kitchen wearing a cute pair of watermelon earrings. Then Anna's dad, Bob Knight, arrives with the real thing.
These watermelons were just full watermelons yesterday, right? And so less than 24 hours ago, they were not even processed, and now here they are.
Glenn grew up near a farm in Russia, savoring the flavors of fresh fruits and veggies.
When I came to America and I went to a grocery store and I tasted the tomato, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. It doesn't smell like a tomato. So I was like, oh, there's got to be a way to get a tomato that I remember. You know, it's the same tomato. Like, where can I find it? So, of course, farmers markets are a good way to go and find it. And then I'm like, well, man, how do I bring it to schools?
There were challenges. First and foremost, Glenn says, farm fresh produce is more expensive. It's also seasonal. Try finding a locally grown watermelon in January. And then logistically, none of it can really work here without the Knights Farm Hub connecting the farmers to the schools, then organizing the payment, communication, and delivery.
That's such a blessing to us as a school district, because instead of six invoices, we have one.
Last year, almost half of the produce served on lunch trays in Upland Unified was grown on a nearby farm. And Glenn says that percentage is growing. So what do the kids think? Over in the school kitchen, lunch lady Lisette Serrano is preparing the day's menu. Valencia oranges from Old Grove Orange in Redlands, Korean seedless watermelon from Sunny Park's farm in Moreno Valley, and also tacos.
It's build your own taco, literally, so everything's going to go by super quick. So we're constantly
as soon as lunch begins, elementary schoolers descend upon the taco bar. Shredded cheese and lettuce start flying, and so does the fruit.
They go crazy over the watermelon.
Crazy indeed.
I like watermelon.
It's super sweet. And not watered down.
It's like really juicy and good.
It's pretty good. It's pretty sweet. I should have tried it earlier.
The juice, the flavor are like the goodest thing.
Second grader Desilu Padilla has piled 3 oranges onto her plate and appears thrilled to learn they were just picked from a nearby farm.
In the farm? So cool.
The state of California is investing in reactions like these. So far this year, millions of dollars in grants have supported school districts, small farmers, and food hubs participating in farm-to-school programs. The Knights were able to replace their broken-down delivery truck, and Upland Unified School District sent kids on field trips to their farm to learn about who grows their food and where it comes from. For KCRW, I'm Robin Estrin.
And special thanks to interpreter Nancy Lee for her work on this story as well.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you've endured the grueling process of apartment hunting in LA, You know that affordable housing is really tough to come by these days. Average rents have more than doubled in the city over the past decade, even in neighborhoods that were historically accessible to people who were working class in LA. So where did all that affordable housing go? That's at the center of a new exhibition at Beyond Baroque Gallery in Venice Beach, featuring giant maps and photography and poetry. Yes, poetry. It examines the policies that led to the removal of nearly 1,500 rent-controlled housing units from the beachside neighborhood and the long-term effects that that's had on the community. The exhibit focuses on the impact of the Ellis Act, which allowed landlords to evict tenants to redevelop affordable housing so they can lease those at higher prices. Artist Judy Brantman launched the project after her own experience with eviction, and she joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Steve.
So where did all the affordable housing go? I mean, this is the question of the ages in L.A. And how is it inspired by your own story about housing and your housing here in L.A.?
Well, it was inspired by that. I was got an eviction notice. It was a long time ago now. And when in 2003, I was at sort of the beginning of this whole thing.
So this is about what you went through, but it's also about what other people have gone through too, right? Like you've collected testimonials about all this.
Right. I got a list of all of the Venice, you know, properties that were Ellis'd. And at first I thought, oh, I'm just going to go out and take photos of them all. And gradually over the years, I realized it should be more of a community project because it's a community problem. And so a bunch of organizations and people from Venice and other places got together. And this spring, we did a series of workshops where we both learned about Venice and housing and went out and took pictures of all these properties. And in the process, it rained a lot. So we spent some time chatting with each other and with other people. And a journalist came in who had written about the tenant anti-harassment ordinance. And we quickly realized that, and from our own experiences, that harassment is even more of a problem, common problem. Many, many people are sort of chased out.
Obviously, this is about shining a spotlight on this issue. But what would you call it an exhibit? What would you call this? Because I mentioned photography and maps, big maps and poetry. That sounds like an exhibit.
Oh, it is an exhibit.
Yeah.
And throughout the Beyond Baroque Literary Arts Center, you walk in and you see a huge map and you see poetry on some plastic. You see other maps. There's each piece of it sort of tells a different piece of the story. One of the members of our group who was part of, you know, our workshops throughout, had been homeless for 20 years. And so she has sort of a whole area where she shows her all the pieces, her doll making and writing and painting that were all part of her healing process that enabled her to, a year ago, move into her first home in Venice in, you know, over 20 years.
And there's story after story of people who are on the street right now.
Right.
Who've gone through similar experiences.
Yeah, it doesn't take much for many people. I mean, that you losing your home and not being able to pay rent is just a month away for many people. And we did do some census exploration of who lives in Venice. And over the past, I guess from 2000, they started looking, since maybe 1980, they started looking at people who were paying between 35% and 49% of their income on housing. But then 20 years ago, they realized, oh my goodness, there's a whole other category, which is 50% or more of your income going to rent.
And the ideal number, by the way, is under 30, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Talk a little bit about the map, because I mentioned the big map that you have there that you've included in your show. What is it a map of, and how did you get all this data?
Well, the map is a big map that we
of Venice.
Of Venice that's, yeah, you know, 9 feet by 10 feet. And on it we put all the photos that we took. And then there's actually poetry and other things written on the streets more and more is appearing. So it's sort of both the personal and the political right there, you know, what we've lost and how it feels to people. So yeah, that's the first thing you see. And there's a legend that tells you what you're looking at, each property. It shows how many units were lost there. I mean, the strange things. So there's about 1,400 units lost to the Ellis Act. But we also found in Venice that we have sort of a unique situation because we have all these very old hotel-looking buildings along the boardwalk that, in fact, were deemed to be rent-stabilized, rent-controlled buildings. There's about 200 units, and almost all of those buildings have been bought and turned into short-term rentals or hotels. There's about 200 and something units that have been taken off the rent control market, basically illegally.
Who do you want to come see this, right? Who is going to come see this, and what do you want people to take away from it?
We want everyone to come see it. You know, LA is 60% tenants or more. So,
but do you want lawmakers? Do you want city leaders? Do you want neighborhood associations?
We'd love to have the city, you know, council members, assembly members. In fact, at our opening, Tina McKinner's staff was there and gave us.
And Tina McKinner is a California assembly member, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And we would love to have other people come and talk about it with us, help us understand how this is happening or why this is happening. But for many people who just come, homeowners, tenants, people are shocked, you know, to see the number of it and the visual, you know, the representation of it. And we did a video which contains a little bit of everything, highlights, as we say. And so, yeah, we would love to have, you know, everyone come, tenants, leadership, people who are working to make change, who want to figure out how that happens.
Again, the exhibit is on display through November 5th, this Saturday, over at Beyond Baroque in Venice. Judy Branfman, director of Where Has All the Affordable Housing Gone? Judy, thanks for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just ahead, food and drink and weed. Oh my. A new cannabis lounge in WeHo puts everything under one roof, sort of. We'll take you on the journey after this short break. More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Amid the avalanche of bills that descended on Governor Gavin Newsom's desk was one that would have made it legal for Amsterdam-style cannabis lounges to operate across California. Well, the governor said no and took the veto stamp to it. But in West Hollywood, there's a new lounge that hopes to stamp its own unique message of just what kind of a place a cannabis shop should be and what you can do and experience while you're there. And toward that end, Pleasure Med is now open, selling weed, but also serving up bites and booze. With me to talk about it, this new massive cannabis space, is Eater's Mona Holmes, who's also a regular contributor to GLA. Mona, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Good to hear from you.
This place is owned by the people who own the Pleasure Chest, which is a sex shop that's been around for decades across the street from Pleasure Med, right? So tell us a little bit about how those both jibe together.
Yeah, they work really well together. I had a nice long conversation with the owner, Brian Robinson, who has owned Pleasure Chest since 1996. And he noticed that a lot of his customers were coming in and definitely favoring the section that had bongs, pipes, all kinds of cannabis paraphernalia. And so he knew that there was a built-in audience there that was also coming for the Pleasure Chest. And so West Hollywood also developed a system to make its borders very friendly to cannabis consumption in 2017. And so he applied for a license where people can smoke on site. And apparently the city of West Hollywood agreed that this would be a great place and a great business to do just that. So some really good timing, because the building across the parking lot came up for auction. And now there's two restaurants in one building and a retail area to buy cannabis. And there you go. You've got Pleasure Med.
But again, as I mentioned, Gavin Newsom vetoed that bill. So what makes West Hollywood so special? How come Pleasure Med be there?
Well, there's a difference between the bill that Newsom vetoed earlier this month and the existing cannabis consumption lounges that exist today. Assembly Bill 374 was the bill that would have allowed dispensaries to be able to function just like you know, a place where you could go in and get a bag of Cheetos or just a regular drink. By law, they're not allowed to sell any kind of non-cannabis products like coffee or food or sodas. And so it was more designed to help dispensaries because they're not doing so well right now because the cannabis black market is thriving and taking away a lot of their business. So, but it did shine a huge light, Newsom's veto did, on the tricky business of cannabis regulations in California. They are constantly evolving, and legislators are trying to find ways to make things easier for these existing businesses and for the new ones to come.
You're not going to get Cheetos, by the way, at Pleasure Med, right?
You're not going to. You're going to get some good stuff at Pleasure Med.
It's a little more high-end. So talk a little bit about what Pleasure Med is and what kind of bites and booze you can get over there.
Yes, sir. Okay, so I have to admit, I was stunned when I got out of my car. And you name something in the restaurant industry, I've seen it. I've been in this game for a bit. But Pleasure Med, you get into the parking lot after the sun goes down, and there are these beautiful, erotic 3D images projected on the front wall. Nothing offensive, but you just kind of open your mouth and let it fall on the ground. And then you have the choice of entering this retail area on the ground floor that looks like an apothecary. Or you can go to the restaurant in the back. That one's called Hein. Now, this one, it's a covered patio. It's fairly small, but like a really pleasant place to get an alcohol beverage or just something to eat. Both restaurants have the same menu, but you can't consume cannabis there because that would be against California law. You can't consume alcohol and cannabis in the same space. Now, upstairs at Irie, it's huge. It's got tiled floors. It's got these really beautiful vintage style windows that overlook Santa Monica Boulevard. They built the second floor to this space. There's lush plants everywhere. There's a private dining room that looks absolutely decadent. There's a mauve colored lounge, but in any of these spaces upstairs, you can actually purchase something to smoke, but you can't get alcohol there. But this is a place that you would definitely want to hang out in, and you don't even have to smoke while you're there, but it is certainly a vibe, and I highly recommend that anyone get there.
So the downstairs one, the dining room one, right? Like, what kind of food are we talking about? Again, not Flamin' Hot Cheetos, but like something it's pretty
thank
good,
goodness.
Right?
Thank goodness. Well, they both have a menu from Chef Wes Witzel, who is a respected chef in Los Angeles. He used to be the lead at Hatchet Hall until he left earlier this year. And so he was a consulting chef on this project. And the menu feels very fresh. So, of course, there's salads. There's like a really wonderful jerk fried quail with mustard greens. I really love their pizzas, you know, that don't feel like they feel a little unusual and really great. But none of them are infused because that would also be against California law. But you can get both at either Irie or Hind.
Are there more of these kinds of combination spaces happening in West Hollywood where it is sort of that unique area?
There are. There's a handful. You know, the original Cannabis Cafe, also formerly known as Lowell, they are reopening next month. They opened in 2019, but of course they closed during the pandemic, but are plotting a comeback. There's also Woody Harrelson's cannabis consumption lounge called The Woods, where you can go there and get some light bites and smoothies and the like. There's also the Artist Tree, which is one of the more prominent dispensaries that opened in April of last year. And it's continuing to thrive. But once this is all done and every single applicant that got an approved license, you'll have 16 cannabis consumption lounges in the borders of West Hollywood. But I don't see that happening for at least many, many years for now. It's a hard business to get approved, but we're going to have to see.
And you'll keep us updated, I'm sure. Mona Holmes
always.
On the Canna Beat from Eater LA, and of course our regular here on GLA. Mona, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
All right, that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow's Halloween? Where has the month of October gone? A lot of L.A. spookiness tomorrow. Local ghost stories. The curse of Griffith Park. It wouldn't be Halloween, of course, without a curse or two. Later on Wednesday, the Day of the Dead. Life among the dead at a famous L.A. cemetery, too. I hope you'll join us for the next couple of days on Greater L.A. Find us online anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us how you're doing. suggest a story idea, and of course, grab the podcast so you can get the show on the go anytime. And get the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just search KCRW, Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all helped run this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that ear tonight. Have a great night.